This is Law and Disorder. Today on Law and Disorder, we get a deeper insight into the dangerously escalating war in Ukraine from Ray McGovern.
Ray McGovern used to debrief President George Bush on the situation in Russia. When he talks about the threat of nuclear war, he knows what he's talking about. We'll also look into the situation of doctors who prescribed opioids to needy patients and what's happened to them.
We learn how at least 1,600 doctors who properly prescribed opioids nevertheless lost their licenses to practice.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
And I'm Jim Lafferty, a decades-long political activist and once the national director of the National Lawyers Guild. The world today is threatened with war, poverty, displacement, and hunger like, well, no other time really since 1937 when World War II began with the Japanese invasion of China. Within 4 years, the war had spread, leading to the death of tens of millions of people, including 50 million Russians, 400,000 Americans, and finally hundreds of thousands of Japanese civilians in 1945 when the U.S. initiated the nuclear age with the bombing of Hiroshima and Nagasaki, in order really just to demonstrate America's power to the Russians. This initiated the Cold War, which is now in its second stage, and it must be stopped. What is desperately needed is a unified American peace movement. We speak today with Ray McGovern. He was once a top official in the CIA and frequently debriefed President George Bush about Russia. The American proxy war in Ukraine against Russia is based on the lie that they were unprovoked but nevertheless invaded Ukraine. The American wars in Vietnam and Iraq were based on lies as well. We were told in 1965 by President Lyndon Johnson that the Vietnamese had attacked American ships in the Gulf of Tonkin. That was a lie. In 2003, we were lied to by President George W. Bush, who told us that Saddam Hussein had weapons of mass destruction, and we know that was BS. The U.S. proxy war in Ukraine against Russia is based on the ubiquitous lie that the Russians were unprovoked. It threatens to spin out of control, though, now. Why are we in the situation that we are in? What can we do about it? Well, we're grateful to be able to have Ray McGovern with us on Law & Disorder Radio at this most crucial time. Ray McGovern, welcome back to Law & Disorder.
Thanks.
Ray, in your article, Brainwashed into War with Russia, you talk about the role played by corporate media's biased anti-Russian way of covering the war in Ukraine, to such an extent that the Biden administration will, and I quote you, have no trouble rallying Americans for the widest war in 77 years, starting in Ukraine and maybe spreading to China. Why do you say the war in Ukraine may be the widest in 77 years, the widest since the Second World War?
Well, right now, Michael, the two are at loggerheads, that is, U.S., NATO on the one side, and Russia on the other. Now, there is a possibility of the use of nuclear weapons. I do not rate it as very high at the moment, but I rate the ignorance level in Washington as extremely high, okay? So here's a little syllogism for you. Russia is not likely to use nuclear weapons unless it has its back up against the corner. We need to put Russia's back up against the corner. Conclusion? Doesn't make any sense. It's crazy. Yeah, okay. This is the Director of National Intelligence who doesn't get to make the policy decisions. She's telling Biden 3 months ago, look, there won't be any use of nuclear weapons unless we put Putin back up against the wall. That's when he's likely to use them, if ever. And so, Mr. President, you know that, right? Okay. He says, yeah. And then these unwashed, wet-behind-the-ears guys, Tony Blinken and Jake Sullivan, say, well, hey, look, let's tell Secretary of Defense Austin to say, well, what we're really out to is weaken Russia, so I can't ever do this before. And others, of course, are saying, well, we ought to dismember Russia, okay? So it doesn't make any sense, and the rhetorical position of Russia at this point is what it has always been, and that is that we will use nuclear weapons only in these two circumstances. One, if they are used against us, and number two, if there's an existential threat to the existence of our country, we'll use them then too. So the Russian position has not changed. Russia did remind everyone at the earliest, well, in February, that we do have a nuclear arsenal and we're putting it on increased alert. That was new. That was significant. That was provocative. But ever since that time, they've reverted to their long-held principal position, only if it's used against us and only if there's a danger of our country being attacked and falling apart.
In referring to America's role in the war in Ukraine, Ray, of course, the media refers to that role as a proxy role, that it's a proxy role because the U.S. and other NATO nations are only supplying billions of dollars in military hardware to Ukraine. But we're doing more than that, aren't we? I mean, we are now also having our own generals and military strategists actually directing the Ukrainian military on how and where to fight the war. So isn't it already the case that the United States and NATO are at war with Russia?
Yes, they are. And the Russian leaders are now saying that. And everybody pretty much realizes that without NATO and especially U.S. support, Ukraine could not form any problems to Russia. Now, the key term that's been used is unprovoked, okay? A Russian attack on Ukraine was unprovoked. Now, I've been around long enough to see a direct analogy to something called the Cuban Missile Crisis. Now, those of you who need to know this, let me just explain what happened. We told the Russians never put offensive missiles in Cuba. Nuclear weapons, that's verboten. We will react very strongly. Khrushchev sort of thought that was bluff. And so he put missiles in Cuba. This was exactly, well, it's 1962. What did I make it? 60 years ago, this month, okay? Now, what did Kennedy do? Kennedy saw that as an existential threat to the United States. Now, when great powers see an existential threat to their sphere of influence, if they're powerful enough, they counter it, okay? This is the real world, okay? This is not the Blinken world. Lincoln says, oh, there's no such thing as spheres of influence anymore. It's passé, you know, okay? Well, it isn't passé anymore. The point is, look, what did JFK do? Well, he felt provoked, okay? And what did he do? He ordered a quarantine of very dubious legality. Most people say pure and simple illegal to prevent more Soviet ships from shipping more missiles in. And then what did he do? Well, then he threatened, get this now, he threatened nuclear war. Again, that's against all the provisions in the United Nations. You're not supposed to even threat such a thing. I don't think he was bluffing. And I had a personal experience because I reported on active duty as a second lieutenant in the U.S. Army at Fort Benning Army Infantry Training School, and there were no weapons there on the 3rd of November, 1962. They were all in Key West, ready to invade Cuba, okay? So we would not be alive now if it weren't for John Kennedy standing up for existential existence for us and getting a deal with Khrushchev where he gave some, said, we'll take our missiles out of Turkey if you take those missiles out of Cuba. And Khrushchev said, all right, well, Kennedy sees this as an existential threat. We'll take him out, and then we'll say to our generals, oh, they're taking him out of Turkey, and a deal was cut. Now, how does it look now? Do the Russians see that kind of existential threat? Well, Americans have no idea that there are missile bases in Romania already operational. There are missile bases on the border with Russia in Poland, and there was an attempt, or the Russians were going to try to prevent them being put in place in Ukraine. What am I talking about? I'm talking about, quote, alleged or notional anti-ballistic missiles to defend against, we said, Iran. It doesn't have any nuclear warheads or that kind of missiles. And they've been put in Poland. Now, these are capsules. These are holes in the ground. Easily accommodate cruise missiles and when the U.S. gets to hypersonic missiles. Now, Putin warned on the 21st of December, speaking before all his generals and admirals, look, if that happens, if they put a little disc in their computer and convert these so-called ABM sites into, let's say, cruise missiles, that gives me 7 to 10 minutes to decide whether I'm going to destroy the rest of the world, okay? If they put hypersonic missiles in these sites, easily converted into launch pads for hypersonic missiles, that gives me 5 minutes, 5 to 7 minutes. I can't tolerate that. That's an existential threat. Now, do Americans know that? No, they don't know that. And what they also don't know is that when they agreed last December, that is the U.S. and Russia, to talk about these things, okay? Putin called up Biden and said, look, we need to talk right away. That is, the Kremlin got in touch with the White House. Okay, this is on the 30th of December last year. And the White House was flummoxed. They said, well, look, we're meeting in, our negotiators are meeting in Geneva on the 6th and 7th of January. What's the big rush? And the answer was, Putin needs to talk to Mr. Biden right now. What happened? We have the readout. It's the Russian readout, and it has not been challenged by the United States. The readout is this. Mr. Joseph Biden said that the U.S. has no intention of putting offensive strike missiles in Ukraine, period, end quote. Whoa! Those negotiations were going to be off to a wonderful start. The Russians were rejoicing. And what happened? Well, when Biden woke up the next day, Sullivan and Blinken came and said, now, you didn't really promise that, did you? Well, yeah, I did. It fell through the cracks. And 6 weeks later, the next time the two of them talked, Biden and Putin, Putin complained bitterly that that promise, that that undertaking, that conciliatory gesture had dropped through the cracks and was no longer viable. Okay, so this is the 12th of February. What happened less than 2 weeks later? The invasion of Ukraine, which we are told religiously was unprovoked. Let me tell you, folks, if that was unprovoked, then Kennedy was completely wrong in being so illegal and so forceful and so threatening of nuclear war in responding to what he saw as an existential threat to the United States way back 60 years ago. You can't have it both ways. Putin is not going to tolerate an existential threat on his borders. And the problem is that no Americans pretty much know that. And I will quote the humorist Will Rogers. He had it right. Listen to this. It's very, very brief. The problem ain't what people know. It's what people know that ain't so. That's the problem. And what Americans know from the New York Times and the others ain't so. And they don't know the other half of things. And that makes it a very dangerous situation.
For those who've just tuned in, we're speaking with Ray McGovern. I'm Michael Smith. I'm with my co-host, Jim Lafferty. Ray, would you agree that the corporate media in America's first misled the American people on the historic reasons behind Russia's invasion and war in Ukraine, and then now they cover the war in such a biased way as to daily demonize Russia while finding no fault with Ukraine or the role of the United States in the war. And if you do agree, might the way that media has covered the war have something to do with who owns the media in America and who stands to profit from America's role in this war?
Well, I think you put your finger on the button here, of course. Eisenhower, of course, warned against the military-industrial complex gathering such power, desired or undesired, so that they threatened our democracy. Well, that was a long time ago, what, 1961? Whoa, what has happened? The military-industrial complex has grown into a monster. I call it the MICIMAT, okay? Here's the acronym, MICIMAT. Got a pencil? So, military, industrial, congressional, intelligence, media, academia, think tank complex. MICIMAT. It rhymes a little bit like Mickey Mouse. You can remember it. Now, why do I say media? Well, the media is the linchpin. You can't do this kind of stuff without the media. The media, as you've already said, is controlled by the same folks that control the MICIMAT, corporations and so forth. They make a lot of money on war, and all this stuff that's going to Ukraine, that's not going to Ukraine, that's going to Raytheon, that's going to Lockheed, that's going to, you know, it's going to all the defense contractors. So if you're a defense contractor, you're sitting pretty high. The rest of us Americans are being denied the funds we need so that our soldiers don't have to have food stamps to feed their kids, and that our infrastructure doesn't crumble as it is as we speak.
In the media today, as you quite rightly point out, Ray, the U.S. can do no harm, and Russia is an evil empire that you know, should be destroyed and wiped off the face of the earth. It doesn't matter what the matter is. If they're talking about war crimes, although the international committees that speak out on war crimes have accused both sides of war crimes here, but it's only the so-called alleged Russian war crimes that make the headlines, given the bias of the media that you've just been describing so well. On the other hand, on the left, online publications from the left and others, Russia can do no wrong, and the United States is the sole culprit here, whereas in the media it's just the opposite. It leaves people very confused. I'm a friend of neither of the Russian government or the United States government, certainly. But what are people to know? How are they to believe? How is the average person in this country to discover the truth of the matter?
That's the key question. They need to tune into programs such as this. They need to find websites that regularly publish the truth. My son, who runs my website, always criticizes me if I forget to mention it. It's raymcgovern.com. He always says, tell them also, Dad. Tell them if they don't get it, they don't get it. You've got lots of folks that are telling the truth. So it's not hard to come by. You have to have incentive to do it. And you have to not be bashful about calling that being called in Putin's pocket. It's crazy. Now, I'd like to make sure that we mention the sabotage of those gas pipelines in the Baltic Sea, because that is an incredible new development. And it really points the question as to what's going to happen when Germans start freezing to death this winter. I say Germans because they're the most important, and because 77 years after World War II, they still haven't figured out how to act like adults. They're still lemming like following the U.S. At every diktat. So I think I need to point out that the key really here is whether the Germans will act any differently from when they acted way back in 1933. Now, I'd like to cite an author. He was a lawyer in training to be a judge. His name was Raymond Pretzel, pen name Sebastian Hafner. Okay? He was in Berlin, 1933, as I say, studying to be a judge, and he observed these things. And this is what he said when his diary was found. He said, quote, "The sequence of events is wholly within the natural range of psychology, and it helps to explain the inexplicable. The only thing that is missing is what in animals is called breeding. This is the solid inner kernel that cannot be shaken by external pressures and forces, something noble and steely, a reserve of pride, principle, and dignity to be drawn on in the hour of trial. It is missing in us Germans. As a nation, we are soft, unreliable, and without backbone." That was shown in March 1933, at the moment of truth, when other nations rise spontaneously to the occasion, the Germans collectively and limply collapsed. They yielded and capitulated and suffered a nervous breakdown. And the result of this millionfold nervous breakdown is the so-called unified nation, ready for anything, that is today, 1933, the nightmare of the rest of the world, end quote. So the question is, can the Germans, facing a winter where Nord Stream 2 cannot be just turned on now? I mean, that was ready. They could turn the spigot. And there are reports that the Germans were negotiating behind the U.S. back with the Russians to make some sort of deal so they wouldn't freeze to death and so that their industry wouldn't fall apart this winter. Well, what happened? Those pipelines were sabotaged. Now, how much are the Germans going to take from U.S. and NATO? I am convinced that the only possible perpetrator was someone who did it at the behest of the U.S. It makes no sense for the Russians to be destroying their own pipeline. Even Tucker Carlson, he had a great fun about exploring the theories as to why Russia would shoot itself in the foot this way. So, long story short, it all depends on whether the Germans will finally say, well, wait a second, this is crazy. Still acting like children or like small adolescents when our people's welfare is at stake. Now, there's going to have to be a different leadership in Germany, but that may be coming, and it may be coming within a month or two, because Germans really don't like to freeze to death, and industrialists there really like to keep operating.
Ray, back in the spring, peace negotiations were underway, and they were actually, as evidence has shown, sabotaged by the United States and NATO. And now the situation is much worse. China's calling for new negotiations, but both sides have not yet been willing to resume the talks. And in terms of wider war, you write about, do you think these new peace talks could get going? And moreover, what about China? Speaking of China, will they get drawn into the war? And would that be on Russia's side?
Well, there's no prospect of early peace talks, particularly if the New York Times keeps telling everyone that Ukraine can win. Take it from me, Ukraine can't win. Now, with respect to China, as usual, you put your finger right on the problem here. Now, when Putin felt diddled once again by Washington reneging on Biden's promise not to put offensive strike missiles in Ukraine, and he looked at the NATO-instructed and equipped forces lined up against Donetsk and Lugansk about to attack, he thought, in March, he was up in Beijing, right? And so he said, now, President Xi, you say I'm your best friend forever. I really appreciate that, but hey, I have to let you know, the Americans are diddling me again. They're right up against our people in Donetsk and Lugansk and, you know, the whole part of the Ukraine. And I may have to invade. I know that you have a principled resistance to invading other countries, but we're going to have to do that. And my notion, I wasn't a fly on the wall, but my notion of the way Xi reacted was, You mean after the Olympics are over, right? Right. This is big. This is really big. Well, the day after the Olympics were over, Donetsk and Lugansk were recognized as independent countries. 2 days later, there was the invasion. Now, would Putin have invaded without Chinese backing, well, I know a little bit about Russian foreign policy and a lot about Putin. I think he would not have done that. So this changes the whole world. There used to be a triangular relationship, sort of an equilateral one, Russia, China, the U.S. Now it's isosceles, if you remember your geometry,
yes.
China
yes.
and Russia with the long arms. Literally, the U.S. has the short end of the stick. And it doesn't seem to realize that. So this is really, really dangerous.
Ray, as it now seems likely, speaking of dangerous, the war may well go on for some years now, it appears. If that's the case, how likely is it that U.S. military advisors, next thing you know, will be on the ground in Ukraine, or maybe even U.S. troops will eventually end up fighting in Ukraine? Is that silly to worry about or not?
Well, no, that could happen. As a matter of fact, it's happening as we speak. There are all kinds of advisors there. The Ukrainians, have been trained by NATO now for 8 years. And there are people not only sharing the latest intelligence with them from satellites and elsewhere, but crowing about it and claiming success when some of these HIMAR missiles strike Russian targets. So we're already involved. The question is how people will react to the very clear threat on two sides. One is the destruction of those pipelines and the fact that a lot of people are freezing, industries will go down. And the other thing is Putin's upping the ante by annexing 4 regions of Ukraine. That's big, okay? And he has to build up his forces to secure those four provinces. Now, that's where we stand now. Militarily, in my view, the Russians can't lose. They can't afford to lose. It's an existential threat. Is Ukraine or the situation in Ukraine an existential threat to the United States? No way. No way is it. And so, we just like in Iraq and Afghanistan, no existential threat to the United States. So we left. Well, I think in the next year or two, maybe earlier, we'll leave. And NATO is really in danger of falling apart, particularly if it comes out as it seems to be already, that U.S. special forces, or as the Russians call them, the organs of state security, were behind the destruction of those pipelines.
Ray McGovern, it's been terrific having you back on Law and Disorder. Thank you so much. Before we have to let you go, please tell our audience how people can follow your work.
Well, my website is raymcgovern.com. I'm on Twitter at Ray McGovern, also on Facebook and Instagram. So I welcome comments and I welcome questions, and please don't hesitate to visit raymcgovern.com.
Thank you so much, Ray McGovern, for being with us today on Law and Disorder, really. Thank you.
You take it easy, Ray.
Bye.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss.
The Center for Disease Control, the CDC, wrongly thought pain management doctors in the USA were overprescribing opioids. the CDC issued guidelines in 2016 putting limits on the amount of opioids doctors could prescribe, thinking that high doses of opioids led to addiction and death. They were wrong. These guidelines were disastrous for chronic pain patients. Many were driven to buy illegal drugs on the street, which were laced with poisonous fentanyl. Many, many committed suicide. This led, in 2021, to 100,000 deaths in the United States. Several insurance companies encouraged the CDC to impose limits on doctors prescribing opioids and to taper their patients. Opioids are very expensive. The insurance companies were fortified in their erroneous belief by the efforts of a certain organization of doctors who were not pain management specialists. When the CDC guidelines were exceeded, the Department of Justice threatened to indict doctors and got them to stop practicing medicine. The doctors gave up their license to practice, and they gave up their license to prescribe narcotics. Some were prosecuted. Some went to prison. Some endured large fines. 1,700 of the 6,000 pain management doctors in the USA were removed from the practice of medicine. Doctors who refused to taper were victimized. Those doctors correctly believed that their patients were dependent on high dosages of opioids, but they were not drug addicts. These doctors understood that denying their patients high dosages of opioids would lead to suicides and deaths by overdose. The United States Supreme Court recently changed things. In their historic ruling, the United States versus Ruan, they ruled that doctors have the right to treat their patients as they see fit without government interference. They ruled that the doctors could prescribe what they thought was best for the patients. We speak today with Kelly Dineen Gillespie, who's a professor of law and the director of the health law program at Creighton University School of Law in Nebraska. She teaches health law and bioethics. Dr. Gillespie holds a PhD in healthcare ethics as well as a law degree. Before attending law school, she worked as a nurse in neurosurgery and transplant ICUs. She co-wrote two Friend of the Court briefs in the significant Ruan case. The Supreme Court in June of 2022 adopted much of the reasoning advanced in these briefs in a unanimous decision supporting doctors. Professor Gillespie, welcome to Law and Disorder. Professor Kelly Dineen Gillespie, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you.
Kelly, a hearty congratulations for your part in the Supreme Court win in the Ruan case last June. Could you please tell us the facts of that case and the issues that were involved?
Sure. So, this was a case against Dr. Ruan, who was a pain management, a board-certified pain management doctor in Alabama. And actually, there were two cases that were heard together. So the first was against Dr. Ruan, who, again, pain management doctor from Alabama. The second was a case against Dr. Khan, who also was a pain management doctor, this time in Wyoming. And in both cases, they had been prosecuted by the federal government for felony drug distribution under the Controlled Substances Act based on their prescribing. Now, in Dr. Ruan's case, the first case, he was convicted of this unlawful distribution under the Controlled Substances Act, among a few other charges, and he was sentenced to over 20 years in prison. Dr. Khan similarly was prosecuted under the same provision of the Controlled Substances Act, the federal drug distribution provision, and he was sentenced to 30 years in prison, again, based on their prescribing. Now, this is the same law. This provision, it's called Section 841 of the Controlled Substances Act. That same provision is used to prosecute doctors and also lay people. So if we think about like drug dealers as conventionally understood, they're also prosecuted under the same law. What was important is the language of that section. So in particular, that section says, and I'm quoting, although I'm omitting a few of the words in between just for clarity, it says, quote, except as authorized, it shall be unlawful for any person knowingly or intentionally to distribute a controlled substance. Okay? Now, again, the words knowing or intentionally appear directly in the law, right? Directly in the statute. Now, the fact that these are physicians means that we have to look at that first part where I said except as authorized, right? So what does authorized mean? Well, in the case of people who can prescribe medications to treat a variety of conditions, they have to be authorized by their state boards of medicine, meaning they have to be licensed. They have to get special permissions beyond that typically in the state to do prescribing of controlled substances. And then they have to apply to the Drug Enforcement Agency and receive additional permissions. That's called a certificate of registration. In everyday parlance, people tend to think about it as their DEA number, right? And that means the federal government, through the Department of Justice, the DEA, say, okay, you've jumped through the hoops, you've met the qualifications. Okay, so once they have that permission, there's a number of different pieces of the law called regulations the agency itself has passed that describe how they have to behave. And the big one under there is that they're authorized to prescribe controlled substances for a legitimate medical purpose in the usual course of professional practice. Okay. So the legitimate purpose and usual course of professional practice are two things that often the prosecutors will try to show that the doctors, in fact, did not prescribe for a legitimate medical purpose in the usual course of professional practice. Okay. But let's get back to the words knowingly or intentionally in the statute. Okay. What has happened in the last, say, 10 to 15 years, since there became a lot of media attention around the so-called opioid crisis, right? And I say so-called not because it's not a real problem, but so-called for reasons we can talk about in a minute. You saw a lot of policymakers, including lawmakers and including law enforcement and including judges, right, who are trying to help, right? And I think that one of the ways that this manifested itself was through the DEA being, you know, a bit more zealous when prosecuting physician prescribers, and judges in at least some of the circuits sort of loosening or eroding the standards for what the government has to prove to actually convict a prescriber. And so by the time we got to this case, by the time the Supreme Court actually heard arguments in these two cases, what had happened, at least three of the federal circuits, the way the country is divided up into federal courts. So in the 4th, 10th, and 11th circuit, all that prosecutors had to prove anymore was that the doctor had acted sort of outside the standard of care, which is another way of saying they committed medical malpractice, perhaps. Okay. And the thing is, conviction under this law, the Controlled Substances Act, is punishable by up to your life in prison and over $1 million per violation fine. Right? If you lose a med mal case, you might lose some money. It might hurt your reputation. Nobody likes to do that, right? Nobody likes to lose a med mal case. But it doesn't implicate your very liberty, right? And part of our argument in trying to get the court to take the case in the first place was, hey, we're all out of whack here. Like the standard for a criminal felony with this kind of punishment attached, like life in prison, right? You ought to have to prove knowledge or intent to do this when you prosecute doctors, just like you have to prove knowledge or intent when you prosecute lay people. And so that's part of it. We have lots of ways the law can deal with even bad doctors, maybe doctors who make mistakes, doctors who aren't maybe doing the best for their patient, or doctors who are trying new things that maybe work, maybe don't work. We have a lot of places where the law can jump in and try to help, you know, and try to prevent that or deal with that. And we ought to reserve, you know, life in prison, you know, the kinds of charges that can lead to life in prisons ought to be reserved for people who aren't acting like doctors at all, right? Mm-hmm. They're acting like drug dealers as conventionally understood.
And I think you've answered this in part by what you've already explained, I suspect. But tell us a bit about the actual decision, which, if I recall right, was this a 9-0 decision, I thought, which is quite remarkable. And the reasoning of the court, what was the principal reasoning of the court and the ultimate decision it made?
Yeah, so yes, it was a unanimous decision. And the court really focused in on what we had advanced and some other folks, right, had advanced in the various briefs, which is we've always had a longstanding tradition in the law that when you have a serious criminal offense, there ought to be what's called the appropriate scienter, or state of mind, the guilty mind, right? So if we're going to put people in prison for this many years, right, that there's a vicious will component that ought to be included, right? And here, we don't have to make it up. It says knowledge or intent. It says knowing or intentionally in the statute. The court said that is what the prosecutors have to prove. They have to prove that a doctor knowingly or intentionally were not acting as authorized, right? Essentially, they knowingly or intentionally were acting not like a doctor, but as a drug dealer as conventionally understood. And that is what the government had to prove. And that was a huge win for lots of people, including not only doctors in general, but the many patients who have conditions for whom the standard of care treatment includes prescribed controlled substances.
That leads me to the next question, Kelly. Please talk about the Center for Disease Control and the role that its 2016 guidelines and those guidelines effects on patients and doctors.
Yeah, so the public understanding or public attention, a lot of media attention, really began to focus after 2013 on the serious, very serious and very real problem of drug poisonings or opioid overdoses. Now, just to be clear, even then, the records really reflect that most of these overdoses were not with opioids alone, right? That they involve multiple substances, and I can talk a bit more about that later. But nonetheless, these events were very much characterized as opioid overdoses, and then they were sort of mischaracterized, but this became the dominant narrative that we meant prescription opioids, and the people overdosing were the patients to whom they were prescribed. That was not actually accurate, but that was the impression, and that, you know, impressions often become reality even in policymaking. And so the CDC put out a guideline, and it was a guideline, not a law, not a requirement. It was a guideline. So it was intended to help give doctors considering prescribing opioids some things to reflect on, right? And they included in there some suggestions about limits per day amounts of what are called morphine equivalents. And what though then happened was that document that was a guideline, that was informational, and had very careful language in it about, like, you have to decide, you have to be, you're the one in there in the very nuanced clinical decision, you know, that's your job. You have to do this in the context of your patient before you. However, it wasn't taken that way. And so insurance companies, state lawmakers, state medical boards, federal lawmakers, they took those guidelines and they took that that daily limit, quote unquote, suggested it was actually a number at which you should like really carefully consider things again, which was 90 morphine equivalents. They took that number, and then providers, insurance companies, and others adjusted downward, because if 90, you know, like the logic I think was if 90 is the number that's like we should be really careful, wouldn't it be better if we pick a number that's lower than that, 60, and then we'll make that the number at which we should be careful, right? And then doctors and practices across the country went, well, gee, if they're looking at 90 and they're looking at 60, like maybe it'd be better if I just got people off of these altogether. And what started happening was doctors, very much out of fear of legal scrutiny, started tapering patients or even abruptly discontinuing patients from drugs that they had been on for a long time, and for the most part, medications which allowed them to function well, right? Suddenly they found themselves involuntarily being taken off the drugs, either abruptly or rapidly, and it started out with sort of anecdotal reports of the harm that this was causing, including many deaths by suicide by patients who were abruptly discontinued, and deaths from drug poisoning when some of the patients turned to the so-called illicit market to get the medication, and then they would get medication that was contaminated with other dangerous drugs and also was at variable concentrations, right? And this became such a serious problem that the FDA issued warnings, other major medical groups issued warnings, and the CDC revised their guidelines. Now, the next revision hasn't been fully operationalized, but it's there and should be coming. But, yeah, we ended up doing more harm than good. And there was a recent article about a month ago that showed that, like, actually it's safer to just leave patients on. Patients who have done well, just leave them on, because tapering, even slow tapering, can be associated with more harm.
My goodness. You know, and the numbers of doctors, I hope we will be able to get this. I should say the numbers of doctors who really were committing no crime at all, who were caught up in this and what it's done to them and their practices and so forth, has been really pretty astonishing. There's the matter of the insurance companies. Leave us not forget insurance companies. We're talking about anything medical in this country. Three of the doctors with whom we spoke, in fact, had all lost their medical licenses. They told us that they thought there was self-interest in the insurance company on their part, because those insurance companies would investigate doctors who prescribed opioids. Why? Well, because opioids are extremely expensive. And so the insurance companies, wanting to save money, identified these doctors who were prescribing opioids, these expensive drugs, to the Drug Enforcement Agency, which in turn got them prosecuted by the Department of Justice. Is that a fair observation, do you think?
I think it's not an unreasonable perception to have. I can't confirm or deny that that's what happened, but I will say that in this area, in the prescribing of controlled substances, the level of surveillance of both the patients and the physicians willing to prescribe controlled substances is off the charts, right? And so for me, it's very hard to disentangle that, because, you know, you have tremendous issues with both insurance companies looking hard at what doctors are prescribing, but also we have prescription drug monitoring programs that have, you know, in some states, law enforcement can very easily get to those and have admitted that they look at those for patterns to try and identify people, right? It's also cascading. So once the government investigates, it often comes to the attention of the medical board, right? And then the insurance company hears about it. And so it's really hard to disentangle, but I will say that, you know, prescribing controlled substances to people with highly complex medical conditions, including chronic pain and substance use disorders or opioid use disorders, these are complex, complex medical conditions that require nuance and context. And these surveillance tools are almost completely devoid of that context, the ability to accommodate that context. And so things that are far from black and white get turned into black and white situations. everybody suffers.
How are the doctors identified for prosecution? I understand from speaking with Dr. Neil Annan that a company that worked with the insurance companies used algorithms to identify doctors. That is, the doctor told me that these algorithms looked at the doctor's income, how many patients they had, the distance the patients traveled to visit the doctor, the value and location of the doctor's home, the price of his cars, his overall wealth, and if the doctor was treating patients who had come to them from other doctors whose license had been taken away. Is this, in your experience, a fair observation that Dr. Annan made?
Well, so I don't know the exact content of, like, proprietary algorithms that the insurance companies use, but what I will say, and there's a woman named Jennifer Oliva who co-wrote the briefs with me and also has done some fabulous work on the discriminatory algorithms that are included in the physician drug monitoring programs across the country. And they calculate things in those that include, like, did the patient pay cash? How far does the patient have to travel? Is the patient a woman? Has the patient identified themselves as having a history of abuse or sexual abuse, right? Their race, a whole lot of other things that generate something called a risk score is highly problematic, right? Because what it does is it puts people who are already at disadvantage, so like rural folks who have to drive far distances or people who having problems with their insurance or maybe don't have insurance and so they do pay cash, so we're like further disadvantaging the most disadvantaged folks, right? Now, some of the things that you mentioned about the doctors, those are the kind of things that you do see that show up in descriptions or the indictments or the proceedings from the government. Will talk a lot about, like, how much the doctor makes, right? Like, they will talk about their wealth, all in, like, the sort of idea to suggest that it was personal enrichment that drove their medical decision-making, right? It is problematic.
Speaking of Dr. Annan, who investigated these analytics that you've been talking about in response to Michael's question, he told us that in addition to the factors that I think Michael asked you about and mentioned, that race and age and religion were factors. That can't be legal.
Yeah. So, again, I do not know the content of the, like, private company insurance sort of algorithms they use. But I will say this, and this is the subject of future research I hopefully, along with Professor Oliva, hope to do. If you talk to people anecdotally who work in this area and defense attorneys in particular, they will tell you that it's pretty clearly the doctors that get prosecuted tend not to be white doctors, right? They tend to be physicians of color and physicians that practice in areas where they're serving disadvantaged populations. You know, it's often people who are serving folks who have very little insurance or no insurance, right, are on Medicaid, right, in medically underserved areas, so they don't have a lot of choices in doctors, right, that might be the only doctor in the area that'll take care of them. And again, I don't have data that's like there's absolutely a correlation, so this is anecdotal, but I have heard it from enough people that we, you know, want to do further research on this, because it shouldn't be a surprise, really, that the defendants in controlled substances, you know, cases would also follow the same pattern that they follow for lay defendants, right, which are just proportionately black people and other people of color as opposed to white people. So it wouldn't be shocking that it would follow that same pattern when it's prescribers.
This is Attorney Michael Smith. I'm with my co-host, Attorney Jim Lafferty. We're speaking with Professor Kelly Dineen Gillespie. And unfortunately, we're running out of our allotted time. We've got another minute or so. And I wanted to ask one last question, Kelly. Given that of the 6,000 pain management doctors in America, 1,700 have been knocked out and can no longer practice medicine, and given the fact that last year 100,000 people died of overdoses driven into the streets to buy drugs laced with poison, I wanted to ask you finally How has the recent Ruan decision, what kind of effect has it had on the prosecution of doctors, or is it too early to tell?
I think it's too early to tell, but you make an important point. You know, prescribing of controlled substances, particularly opioids, is at its lowest level since the 1990s. And overdose deaths have never been higher, right? So the idea that there's a prescription to overdose to death correlation is pretty hard to support at this point. And the research doesn't support it either. We hope that this will have at least a modest effect that doctors who do want to try and take good care of patients, including people with opioid use disorder, right, will be a little less afraid of law enforcement prosecution and a little more willing to provide the care they think is ethically required.
Kelly, it's just been a real pleasure for Jim and I to have you on Law and Disorder. We admire your work, and we congratulate you on the Ruan decision, and we thank you so much for being our guest on the show.
Thank you very much, Professor.
Thank you. The pleasure was all mine. Thank you so much.
We gotta have peace.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org. That's lawanddisorder.org.
Check.